Welcome to the Guns and Bitcoin podcast, arming you with the tools and stories to thrive and survive the cyberpunk dystopia. What do Bitcoin and guns have in common that makes them a tool for asymmetric defense? Come and take it is the mantra of free men, but is it just an idea? How do we make it real? Today we speak with Jameson Lopp, a self-described professional cypherpunk and the co-founder and CTO of Bitcoin protection company Casa. Using real-world examples, we discuss how cryptography and firearms can fail or succeed to protect our digital and physical property. For digital property, we delve into the story of Larry Harmon, the CEO of Coin Ninja, who was arrested for allegedly laundering $300 million with a Bitcoin mixer and subsequently had all of his Bitcoin hardware wallets seized by the Department of Justice. For physical property, we analyze the 2014 Bundy standoff, an armed confrontation between federal law enforcement and militia member supporters of cattle rancher Cliven Bundy. We close the episode discussing how 3D printed guns meld cryptography with firearms, the apotheosis of come and take it. Join us at our first annual Bear Arms and Bitcoin Conference taking place Saturday, June 13th and Sunday, June 14th in Portland, Oregon. Register today to enjoy 2 days of Freedom Tech in the beautiful Northwest. You will hear from top 3D gun printing designers and engineers. Join a small community free from interference with friendships and Freedom Tech. Learn how to protect your personal and business sovereignty against mobs and censors. You'll have the chance to win silent auctions supporting the Firearms Policy Coalition and BTC Pay Server Foundation. To top off the weekend, enjoy a Sunday morning of target shooting at an outdoor range in the woods. Register today to enjoy 2 days of Freedom Tech in the beautiful Northwest. Go to gunsandbitcoin.com/bear-arms-2020.
Jameson, welcome to the Guns and Bitcoin podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Glad you're here. I've been wanting to do this episode with you for a while. You have a lot of experience both with Bitcoin and with guns, and specifically about what we're going to talk about today, which is come and take it and applying the ethos of come and take it in the real world with real world examples, and talk about how come and take it actually can work and not work, when it works and when it doesn't work, and strategies for actually being able to challenge different adversaries in doing that. So let me just start off with the very first question. So for you, what do Bitcoin and guns have in common that makes them a tool for asymmetric defense against adversaries?
Well, what we're really talking about here is self-empowerment. And of course, with Bitcoin, we're talking about, you know, taking control of your own money, taking it out of the hands of third parties where it can be used against you, or, you know, potentially abused by other people who have control over those third parties. And with firearms, you know, this is a very long-standing history, at least in America, of being able to stand up and defend what you consider to be your rights, your property, your freedoms. And it helps make the, trade-offs between the physical power and resources that you're putting into something so that you can defend yourself against someone with relatively little resources, relatively little physical strength. In many ways, it kind of equalizes the playing field, at least against the other average person, of course. So we'll probably dig into the fact that there are many different types of attackers out there, and you have to have a plethora of different strategies to deal with different types of attacks.
What specifically about Bitcoin allows it to be asymmetric against adversaries? Because we understand guns a little bit better, I think, in this regard. We understand if you have a rifle and you're up in elevation versus other adversaries, but Bitcoin can get a little technical. Could you explain what specifically is it about Bitcoin that gives that protection?
I would say that fundamentally it's about data, it's about cryptography, and how cryptography makes it extremely expensive for someone to break past your digital defenses and access your private data. In the context of Bitcoin, of course, we're really talking about private keys, but more broadly, this can be applied to really anything that is digitized. And so if you are using strong cryptography to encrypt your data, and then once you bring that into the real world and making, you know, many multiple redundant backup copies of that data to make it more robust against any type of loss or natural disaster, you end up with a system that is arguably more robust and more difficult to penetrate the defenses than even something like Fort Knox, for example, which is, you know, defended essentially by military grade personnel and hardware.
So it's a combination of cryptography. That's the foundation for all of this. It's, you can't break math. And then kind of the distributed nature of things and the other elements of Bitcoin that make it difficult to actually take your Bitcoin. So I think the software math part is very strong, but what type of adversaries or attacks can Bitcoin not defend you against?
Well, ultimately, we are unfortunately still human. You know, we are still limited in meat space. And so while you can, with enough dedication and time and effort, create a digital fortress, so to speak, that is essentially impenetrable, what you really end up with is the fact that the weak points, aka the humans who are involved in that, are going to become the main targets by an adversary who has the resources to do so. And so, you know, even when we're talking about extremely high grade security for, you know, high net worth individuals in the Bitcoin space, we still don't have a perfect solution. I don't think we ever will have a great technical solution to the fact that you could still get physically attacked and tortured, or have you know, a loved one you care about kidnapped and ransomed. You know, there are still a completely separate class of problems that are rooted in the physical realm that Bitcoin cannot fully solve. You can protect against some things, but it's unfortunately not at the level yet where we can, you know, digitize ourselves and use the same types of defenses that we can for Bitcoin.
And you've done a lot of work in terms of protecting people, you know, yourself from physical attacks. I know you've been a victim of swatting, and you wrote this really great piece about different strategies you can use to protect your identity and kind of prevent that, because that is the big hole in our defense. And especially when it comes to Bitcoin, it's the meat space. Like you said, if someone can get at you, get at a loved one, then the cryptography doesn't help you as much. So I guess a perfect contrast would be if you're someone that is overseas and you are pseudonymous and you've been very good with your digital trails and everything else. Yeah, Bitcoin is going to be a very powerful asymmetric defense. It's going to be hard to break that. But let's say you're a public person in the US, they know where you are. That's a completely different story. So I want to go through a real world example of this. And this just came out in the news a few days ago, and it's about the arrest of Larry Harmon. And I'm just going to read through this, so if the audience can just bear with me as I read it, because I don't want to miss the details. So this is from CoinDesk, and the title is U.S. Department of Justice Calls Bitcoin Mixing a Crime and Arrest of Software Developer. Larry Harmon was arrested this week for allegedly participating in a money laundering conspiracy worth more than $300 million in cryptocurrency involving darknet marketplace Alphabay. However, the family of the Coin Ninja CEO claims he was never involved with Alphabay. Harmon's case raises pressing questions about developer liability in the crypto industry. In addition to the crypto media site Coin Ninja, Harmon created the Bitcoin mixer Helix, which sends transactions out in mixed batches so individual payments are harder to trace. In its indictment, Department of Justice prosecutors referred to Helix as a money transmitting and money laundering business. Helix enabled customers for a fee to send bitcoins to designated recipients in a manner which was designed to conceal and obfuscate the power or owner of the bitcoins, the indictment continues. This type of service is commonly referred to as a Bitcoin mixer or tumbler. In a statement Thursday, Justice Department Assistant Attorney General Brian Benkowski made the department's views on Bitcoin mixers clear. This indictment underscores that seeking to obscure virtual currency transaction in this way is a crime. So I'll stop there, and then we'll talk about this and then go to the second half. So We think of Bitcoin's fungibility and anonymity as a strength, and I think it is. But what do you see in this development that could possibly threaten that? And going to our larger theme, how does this affect the come and take it idea with your Bitcoin, if it does at all?
Well, the problem is, of course, he still had a meat-spaked sweetness in his setup, which was, at least my understanding, the mixer was custodial, and so it was operated by a business, it was operated by a human, and that's what law enforcement ended up going after. From a protocol standpoint, we already have ways of engaging in coin mixing in a peer-to-peer fashion that is not, you know, intermediated by a third party taking custody. So I don't believe that coin mixing is fundamentally at risk as a result of these latest actions. I think that, you know, custodial coin mixing is certainly a risk, and would not recommend anyone go into that business.
I agree. I think the problem was the custodial, and the non-custodial peer-to-peer coin mixing probably is going to not fall under a crime. We'll see. I know that Treasury Secretary Mnuchin had said some things that sounded pretty ominous, but we'll see what actually comes out of that. So I think your message answer is that in general, this shouldn't prevent the come and take it idea in Bitcoin as long as it's non-custodial. I mean, the coin mixing seems to work if you do it right. So that's the mixing part. Now, let me read the rest of the article. And this is where we talk about how they actually seized his Bitcoin, if you can say that. So since the arrest, Larry's wife, Margot, has received threatening phone calls and texts from unknown numbers saying the harasser knows the location of her home and she is no longer safe there, Gary told CoinDesk in an interview. And quote, now our family is getting threatened because the FBI decided to tell the world that there might be money hidden with us somehow, Gary said. They have no proof of this and are now putting our family in danger. Gary said all his brother's assets have been frozen and he was denied bail over flight risk concerns. As such, the family started a GoFundMe campaign. Margot said, our address is on it, referring to the indictment. At the bond hearing, they alleged that he may have had some more Bitcoin, so that puts us at risk. Gary said the authorities have already confiscated all of his brother's hardware wallets, and Margot doesn't have any more Bitcoin at home. So for these two parts, you wrote that great article about personal security and your privacy and trying to keep people from getting at you. So what would have been different if this family had been able to kind of do all the strategies that you've talked about, and for the state, for the FBI, but then also for these people harassing his wife, Margot, on phone calls?
Yeah, this one's actually tough because, you know, even despite all of the protections that I've put into place, they would not withstand a nation state level attack. You know, if an attacker with essentially unlimited resources, you know, agents of the state, decided to spend enough time and effort unraveling everything that I had put together, they would be able to do that. And that's because I used legal methods of doing so. And, you know, they would have to spend a lot of time subpoenaing various entities and, you know, essentially peeling off the layers of the onion that I've set up. But I think that even I would eventually have to worry about the same type of thing. This is something where I think the real answer is just not putting all of your eggs in one basket. We don't know the details of how his personal hardware devices were stored. If they were all in his house, then I would say that was a pretty terrible decision. Or if they were all in places that were associated with his name, that's also a pretty terrible decision. I do believe that from a private key standpoint, my own, you know, distributed setup is robust against a higher level of potential attacker. But then this issue just with the home and the address, like the only real solution I see to that is to, you know, have multiple homes and addresses, preferably that are obscured in different ways, so that at least if your primary address gets burned, you can go somewhere else very easily.
Those are good points. So there's really not much of a protection against the state when it comes to your privacy and your home. Do you think it could at least maybe slow it down. And what I'm thinking about is red flag laws in swatting. So let's say, and this happened to a guy, Alex, he goes by Whiskey Warrior, and it was kind of a confusing situation. But the bottom line is, if someone calls in a red flag against you and you're inside your house and you see them coming, would greater security measures at least slow them down, buy you even a couple minutes to maybe call 911 or broadcast on social media, prevent something really bad happening, like kicking down the door and possibly killing you? Do you think you could at least slow down that, or does that not help that at all?
I think there's way too many variables to make a broad general statement. In my own circumstance, my local police department was somewhat skeptical about the validity. And so they didn't just go in guns blazing, kick down the door. They actually just shut down the whole neighborhood and established a perimeter and were like getting the lay of the land and trying to figure out what to do. And, you know, I could only speculate as to what would have happened if I had not made contact with them first, coming from outside of their perimeter that they had established. I mean, it is certain that, you know, if you have a sufficient level of perimeter defenses, that will slow down any entry to some extent. But then, of course, you have to get into the nitty-gritty details of exactly what your perimeter defenses are. And of course, you know, SWAT teams are especially trained in being able to break through perimeter defenses as efficiently as possible.
Absolutely. And then going back to protection, it's not great against the state, but against just harassers. Like in the article, it says Larry's wife was being harassed, and maybe they will escalate to coming by the house if they know where she lives. Hopefully not. But I think in those cases, what you've written about in terms of privacy protection and home protection, I would think that would be a pretty strong defense against those types of adversaries.
Yeah. And in general, even, you know, when I received various threats online, I was fairly confident that these people were not going to risk their own lives by physically showing up at my residence. But, you know, that is, it's sort of a risk trade-off. You have to kind of make those decisions yourself as to whether or not you think particular threats are serious. At the end of the day, you know, you want to be prepared for as much as you possibly can afford to. And that is why in the home defense post that I just made a week or so ago, I specifically talk about how home defense is not just about having a gun. It's not just about having an alarm system. It's about establishing as many layers and perimeters to a defensive system as possible, so that each of those layers has the potential to dissuade completely an attacker, or at the very least slow them down a bit.
I think a lot of this is deterrence, both for your Bitcoin and how you protect it, and also home defense. To what extent is this just deterrence? So people kind of know maybe what your house is or what your Bitcoin setup is, and they just decide it's not worth it.
I think the thing that most people have to worry about is just crimes of opportunity. You're probably not going to be specifically targeted unless you're a highly public figure. Really more likely is someone's just going to be going around canvassing your neighborhood in the middle of the day when most people are at work and try to look for a house that looks like they'd be able to kick in the door, run in for a minute or two, grab some expensive stuff and run off. And other than that, you know, once you start going down the path of what type of attackers might I have to worry about if they are specifically targeting me? That's when you have to worry about, you know, more heavy duty security and even, you know, just sort of day to day life of like, you know, what if someone just comes and wants to surveil me and wait until I'm no longer in my house and want to do something, to kidnap me or extort me or whatever. So, that's when you get into almost the level of having a security professional evaluate your day-to-day life and, figure out your routines and whether or not there are behavioral and lifestyle changes that you could make to further harden yourself as a target.
You have a GitHub page that shares the different attacks on Bitcoiners, and then CoinShare, who we've had on the podcast, did a talk based on that, and he's a former law enforcement officer, and he talks about the different things you can do to protect yourself. I'll put a link to those in the website. So let's go on to the second part of this arrest of Larry Harmon and about his Bitcoin. So they said that they took all of his Bitcoin, but they actually said they took all of his hardware wallet. And there's a debate about what's the best way to secure your Bitcoin. Is it with a custodian that has different offices in Switzerland and New York? Is it multi-sig? Is it a hardware wallet that's in a vault? So we like to think that Bitcoin is resistant to seizure. We like to think, you know, come and take it, come and take my Bitcoin. So in this instance, would multi-signature have helped him, hurt him, or is it hard to know?
It could have helped, but, you know, not if he had all of the keys in locations that were easily accessible or discoverable by law enforcement, or just if he rolled over and you know, pointed out and said, okay, I keep all of my devices hidden in these places. So part of it does come down, once again, to the fact that there will be at least one person and probably multiple people if you have an inheritance set up that will know the location of your private keys, even if you have them split up and distributed. And you kind of have to ask yourself, you know, if I get into a certain situation, do I believe that those people could be compromised? Or even, you know, what would I myself do? And it's hard to even, I think, fathom certain situations. The way that I've tried to portray it for certain clients at Casa is that you shouldn't really make any assumptions about what an attacker will or will not do. This is often comes up in terms of like duress wallets, for example. And also, you probably shouldn't make any assumptions that you yourself will or will not be able to perform certain actions while you're under duress. So, you know, build out your security model based upon those things that, you know, you can't really be sure what people will do. So how then do you distribute your keys in a way that essentially cannot be accessed unless, you know, you are fully compliant?
What could Gary have done? I mean, this is hindsight. We don't actually know the details of things. So this is just an example as a thought exercise. So what would be the best way for Gary to have protected himself, either with like a Casa service or something else that gives him the best chance? Nothing is perfect, but what specifically do you think could have been done to maybe, you know, lessen the chance of this happening, of getting his Bitcoin?
In general, if we're talking about protection against a physical attacker, then you have to set up your keys in such a way that you don't have access to a sufficient threshold of them to spend from them. More specifically, at least against non-nation state attacker, one of the things that we think is fairly safe to assume is that if you keep your keys distributed in multiple access controlled locations that have, you know, different types of authentication required, then it's a lot less likely that someone will kidnap you for a very long period of time and take you through these, you know, locations while you're under duress in order to access them. Now, of course, that doesn't apply to nation states because they will, you know, they can legally force and coerce you basically to do these things. So really, I think the only viable alternatives against that are to either distribute your keys across international borders into countries that don't have any sort of reciprocity agreements with the United States, or just to go super old school and do a like geocaching type of treasure hunt style thing where, you know, the actual locations of your keys are not known by anyone other than yourself. And then, you know, you would probably have to come up with some scheme as well for how to secure the location data, but that would, it would get pretty gnarly.
Yeah. And I just thought of maybe a legal question I should ask one of the attorneys that we've had on, which is if you have a multi-signature setup and your attorney is one of the signatories, does the government have to, or can the government compel the attorney to hand that over? I would think at minimum, he would be able to file something to prevent that, or at least buy some time, because, you know, how the government works is they take all your money so that you can't defend yourself. And maybe if you have Bitcoin set up in a certain way, at least they can only get at it through a longer legal process. So maybe you can have access to it to pay your attorney, maybe not, I don't know the laws on that, but at least maybe you can buy some time, because a nation state is very, very difficult. I mean, they're more likely to win unless they simply have a terrible case and they violate the laws and, you know, you didn't do something, of course. Do you guys at CASA have anything with lawyers? Do you have any lawyers? Do you get into that? Or is that something that's more for customers to try to figure out for themselves if that's what works best?
Well, I mean, each of our clients is unique, and so we're always fielding new types of questions, though I don't believe we've ever fielded a question like that, to my knowledge. We do work with lawyers and estate attorneys, but mostly for inheritance planning purposes. I'm not aware of us ever working with anyone to specifically create a nation state proof style setup, though that would be interesting.
Yeah, if nothing else, to slow them down. And I remember a story from a couple of years ago where there was a guy who owned, I think it was sort of a gas station, mini mart type of food shop. It was a family business he'd owned for decades. And he had a lot of cash payments. You know, it's a convenience store, and he would make the deposits. And the IRS thought he was structuring his payments to basically money launder, but he wasn't. That's just how he made the deposits. They were consistently, I think, right under $10,000. And what ended up happening was the IRS seized his bank accounts, and it was over $100,000, which is basically his life savings. And it took a couple of years to get those back. They, you know, the IRS was wrong. I think they issued an apology. I think they even had some sort of, you know, investigation into the IRS, or they did something where they had to amend their policies and fix some things there. I guess the point is, if he just had that money in Bitcoin, even in just a simple hardware wallet at his house, the IRS couldn't have called up his banks and said, you know, freeze these assets. And that would have bought him time. And, you know, that's a very simple thing. It's not a nation state coming after him like we've talked about, but it prevents just kind of mistaken identity or just, you know, kind of a mistake.
Well, yeah. And also just, you know, civil asset forfeiture in general. We've seen many, many cases of people who are just carrying large amounts of cash. And due to the combination of the war on drugs and the legal ability for law enforcement departments to seize any drug-related asset and use it to fund their own enforcement, now you've created these perverse incentives where many enforcement agencies are just saying, oh, you're carrying too much cash. You must be a drug dealer. We're going to take that. Thanks for your money.
Yeah. So it's not all or nothing with Bitcoin. It's not either you have complete protection against seizure of your Bitcoin or you have none. It's on a gradient depending on your setup and depending on who the adversary is. And I think almost everyone, the real threat will be just kind of a dumb criminal, a crime of opportunity, like you said. It could even go to like, you know, border patrol, law enforcement. When you go across the border, that's a common site where they want to take your cash or they pull you over. So it would protect you there. And even if they take your hardware wallet, you can still restore your seed and have your money to access to defend yourself. So I think the message here is do what you can to protect your Bitcoin so you can truly say, come and take it and just know the limits and do what you can with what you have where you are. And then over time, trying to work up and beef that up.
It's tricky, though, because I would actually say, you know, while we're focusing on actual attacks here in this episode, the most common way that people are going to lose their Bitcoin is due to their own negligence or due to not having a sufficient level of robustness where they introduce a single point of failure and then, you know, something goes wrong and they can no longer access their private keys. And so that's actually one of the main reasons why I think multisig is such an improvement. Because you are creating and distributing, you know, multiple redundant sets of keys.
This episode is brought to you by Bear Arms and Bitcoin 2020, taking place Saturday, June 13th and Sunday, June 14th in Portland, Oregon. Register today to enjoy 2 days of Freedom Tech in the beautiful Northwest. Go to gunsandbitcoin.com/bear-arms-2020. You will hear from experts in DIY weapons, Bitcoin, and Freedom Tech. Confirmed presenters include Ivan the Troll, JStark1809, Julia Turiansky, AG Leaks, Austin Jones, Jeff Rodriguez, and Carbonite, Ragnar Leithracer. More presenters will be announced. Join a small community free from interference with Friendships and Freedom Tech. Learn how to protect your personal and business sovereignty against mobs and censors. Also, you'll have the chance to win silent auctions supporting the Firearms Policy Coalition and Deterrence Dispense Designers. To top off the weekend, enjoy a Sunday morning of target shooting at an outdoor range in the woods. Event privacy and security. We encourage you to buy your ticket with Bitcoin, use a pseudonym and an email address without personally identifying information, or even better, an email address you create solely for this event. We will check you into the event with the email address you use to purchase the ticket. We will not have a list of names or pseudonyms, and thus we will not ask for ID. If you pay with Bitcoin, you don't need to enter a billing address during checkout. For the mailing address, you can make up an address since your ticket won't be mailed. We are welcoming to people who will wear surgical masks, sunglasses, hats, fake beards, or anything else to protect their identity. Photography, video, and sound recording are strictly prohibited. We will not record any sound or video during the event. Register today to enjoy 2 days of Freedom Tech in the beautiful Northwest. Go to gunsandbitcoin.com/bear-arms-2020.
My first Bitcoin that I lost was years ago. I encrypted my DAT file and I thought I would remember the password. This is before I understood what password managers were, like Keykeeper and some other ones. And so I encrypted it. I put this password on it. Actually, it was a passphrase that I thought I would never forget. I think it was a combination of like my first car, my birthday, the name of my dog, and I think like a couple of dates or something. And I tried for a long time with different passwords and passphrases, and I couldn't do it. So still to this day, I have some Bitcoin there. But yeah, absolutely. User error is the main thing. So whether you use multi-sig or just something simple that you can do is going to work. And that also goes under duress. You talked about how capable are you under duress? And they teach that too in firearms training. When I got my CCW, we didn't just shoot at a static target. Like, we shot in the dark, we shot, you know, moving around, shooting from the left hand, the right hand, laying down, because duress completely changes things when it comes to guns or trying to access your Bitcoin, right?
For sure. It's hard to predict how you'll react, and that's why training is important.
You got to practice makes perfect and run through different scenarios. For example, I think, let's say today you wake up and say, hey, let's just practice. If all of a sudden I need to access my Bitcoin, 2 minutes, can I do it? Whatever your setup is. And I think that's a good training exercise. So now I want to move on to the come and take it idea, but for guns and for real property. So I want to go over this. So come and take it for guns or real property. And for our example, I want to talk about the Bundy standoff and the Battle of Bunkerville. Are you familiar with the Bundy standoff and Battle of Bunkerville?
Somewhat. I don't know all of the details, but of course it was on the news for, I believe, several months.
Yeah, well, it's a long story that actually was drawn out over actually years when you look at the legal cases and everything. But for those who don't know, basically, there's a cattle rancher family called the Bundys in Nevada, and they had been grazing their cattle on federal land for decades, I think even for generations. And the family wasn't paying their fees to graze on the land. And so over the years, eventually this came to a head. The BLM, I think, won a case that allowed them to go out and seize the cattle because he wasn't paying those fees or taxes. And then there was actually an armed standoff between the Bundy family and some members of kind of a militia and people who came to volunteer to stand up against the BLM and some federal agencies that showed up to take his cattle and enforce the laws, basically. So if people were just stay with me, I'm going to read this from Wikipedia just to make sure I get the details right, because that's actually very important. So this was on April 12th. So on the morning of April 12th, an armed crowd rallied under a banner that read, "Liberty, freedom, for God we stand." Most had signs, many of which chided government thugs. Addressing the protesters, Bundy said, "We definitely don't recognize BLM director's jurisdiction or authority, his arresting power or policing in any way. And we're about ready to take the country over with force." After the BLM announced suspension of the roundup, Bundy suggested blocking a highway. Armed protesters blocked a portion of Interstate 15 for more than 2 hours, causing traffic backups for 3 miles in both directions. Protesters also converged at the mouth of Gold Butte, the preserve where the cattle were corralled, and a tense, hour-long standoff ensued. BLM Rangers warned over loudspeakers that they were prepared to use tear gas. Former Arizona Sheriff Richard Mack, who was with the protesters, said that they were strategizing to put all the women up at the front. If they are going to start shooting, it's going to be women that are going to be televised all across the world getting shot by these rogue federal officers. Protesters with rifles took positions on a highway overpass, offering cover as horse-mounted wranglers led protesters to face off against BLM Rangers and snipers. Utah Lieutenant Governor Spencer Cox, who officially traveled to the Bundy standoff to convey that Utah did not want the cattle, put the number of federal agents present at over 200. According to Las Vegas Assistant Sheriff Joe Lombardo, there were 24 BLM Rangers and Las Vegas deputy sheriffs present at the standoff. Las Vegas police were not allowed to wear protective gear because of fear that it would be seen as a provocation. Clark County Sheriff Glepsy blames escalation of the situation on the BLM, stating to the Las Vegas Review-Journal that the BLM has lied to him about having a place to take the cattle, and BLM did not attend town hall meetings and disregarded his advice as county sheriff. So what ended up happening was the federal government, the BLM, and FBI stood down. And let me just read this last part that explains this. The Las Vegas Review-Journal reported that tensions reached a critical level during the standoff with rifles pointing toward each side. Las Vegas station KLAS-TV also reported that guns were pointed at officers. Assistant Sheriff Lombardo recounted that they were in my face yelling profanities and pointing weapons and said we were outgunned, outmanned, and there would not have been a good result from it. And then finally, a photojournalist from Reuters wrote that armed supporters had taken up tactical positions on government officers and that one man pointing a rifle in the direction of BLM employees said, I've got a clear shot at four of them. Another man said, I'm ready to pull the trigger if fired upon. So eventually, the Las Vegas Police Department de-escalated the situation, and basically the federal government left. So thanks everyone in Jameson for letting me read all that. Taking this to come and take it. So they came to take his horses, his physical property, and it appears that by being armed, he was able to prevent them from coming and taking it. So what is a lesson that you see here with the Bundy standoff, either good or bad?
Well, you know what it is? It's about discrepancy of force. And one thing that I always get a tickle out of when, you know, anti-firearm folks on social media will harangue me with things like, you know, if the government wants to come for you, your AR-15 isn't going to stop them. It's because they're all assuming a situation where it's just me in my house and then, you know, a plethora of agents surround my house and do whatever they want. And in a situation like that, they're completely correct. I mean, you know, one person with a gun against dozens has no chance. It doesn't matter how much training you have. But the thing about this is that, you know, agents of the state are humans. I think in most cases they believe they're doing the right thing, but they're not in the business of getting themselves killed. I mean, they're not like law enforcement officers are not the same as military personnel, even though some of them may have former military training. You know, they are civilians, even though law enforcement press often likes to try to differentiate between civilians and law enforcement. Law enforcement officers are civilians. You know, there's only civilians and military, and they're clearly not military. So point being, when law enforcement or agents of the state are going to do some sort of enforcement action, they meticulously plan this so that they have an overwhelming discrepancy of force. I mean, you know, it's the shock and awe factor, if you will. Because they want to minimize the risk of harm or injury happening to themselves and generally, you know, disregard whatever is on the other side of the gun that they're pointing at. So if we want to get into a situation where it's this come and take it mentality and we are trying to stand up against agents of the state, then it doesn't have to be, you know, a perfectly one-to-one number. Unfortunately, you know, from all of the stuff that I think the Wikipedia article talks about, I'm not sure that they ever actually give us a number of how many armed protesters there were. But even if there were only a couple of dozen, I think it changes the situation drastically so that the agents who are there to perform the action no longer feel like they have, you know, a 99% chance of coming out of this alive. And that is really what changes the game, is when you're escalating things to the point that people's lives are on the line. And that's really what I think that assistant sheriff was making the point of, was that, you know, they were outgunned, and even though they may have been able to quote unquote win a battle, I think it would have ended up with heavy losses of life on both sides, and that was just not worth it.
So when it comes to come and take it, we also need to remember just pure numbers. So if it was just Clive Bundy with his deer rifle, it would have been different. I mean, they would have just taken him away and it wouldn't have been a problem. But when you start adding more people, especially if they are taken seriously because they have different rifles, they appear that they're wearing body armor, they appear that they know what they're doing, they're coordinating, that's a completely different story. So come and take it also can involve relying on other people, not just trying to be a lone ranger, and also deterrence. You know, I think that's what you were talking about, was they were just deterring something bad from happening because the law enforcement officers looked at the equation and said, you know what, this isn't worth it. We're used to being in the overwhelming force. We're not that. I'm just a regular guy. This is just my job. Do I want to risk one of these guys, you know, getting a shot at me? And they just decided no. And I think this might be one reason why the Bundy standoff ended peacefully rather than turning into a Ruby Ridge or a Waco, where the federal government had a clear, overwhelming amount of power. So what do you see the difference between Ruby Ridge, Waco, and then the Bundy standoff as well?
Yeah, I mean, I think Ruby Ridge was fewer than a dozen people, right? And then I forget how many people were in Waco, but also, you know, Waco was a compound and they had basically barricaded themselves in there and they were completely surrounded by, if I recall correctly, some like heavy armor. And you know, somehow that fire got started. I suspect that I think most of the deaths from Waco were actually fire related and not firefight related. But, you know, we can break down the situations all day long, but you know, there's so many variables to take into account. It's hard to say precisely that, you know, oh, if we only changed this one variable, then the whole outcome would be different. In this situation, like you said, it has decades of history, and it's not just one small like family or one small cult or whatever. It's that they actually had a diverse group of individuals who ended up uniting around a common cause.
And also the history, I think the tragedy at Waco, I think changed some things on all sides. And I think social media and the proliferation of the internet, everyone being able to upload photos and videos, have actually in some ways helped people, because that's another cost we haven't talked about, is the cost to reputation. And sometimes the state seems to get away with things and other times they actually don't. What role do you see the rise of mobile phones and social media playing in helping people prevent adversaries from taking their Bitcoin or taking their guns or taking their property?
That's tough, because I actually most often think of it the other way around, is usually that, you know, social media can result in you leaking information that, you know, creates weaknesses and makes you a more viable target for people. Though, if we are talking about, you know, nation state level attacks, then the ability to spread information so quickly that it can't be censored, I think is an important factor that results in us being able to create these social movements at a pace that wasn't really possible before. So, you know, there was a lot of, you know, grassroots effort, like during the civil rights era, you know, during the various anti-war protests in Vietnam and moving forward. And I can only imagine, you know, how different or how much more accelerated those things would have been if they had been able to proliferate using modern technology at the speed of light, rather than having to rely more upon word of mouth and people actually picking up and making phone calls to one another and newspapers and all the other types of traditional communications.
So social media, the internet, is a double-edged sword. On one hand, it can help you, like you said, the examples of civil rights, maybe with the Bundy Ranch standoff, it could raise the reputation cost of certain people, might spread ideas. On the other hand, it can leak your information. And CoinSure talked about this on his podcast, referring to attacks on Bitcoiners. And I think it's also in your GitHub. And he was talking about, hey, look at a basic strategy is your OPSEC. Your basic strategy is to not advertise certain things, whether it's where you are, where you're going, who you're with, all sorts of things. So social media is kind of a blessing and a curse when it comes to your security. We've talked about come and take it in terms of Bitcoin and in terms of physical property and even guns. So I want to put this all together and apply the come and take it philosophy to 3D printed guns, because 3D printed guns are interesting. They're both digital and physical, so they offer some unique advantages when it comes to asymmetric defense. And so let's talk about that. How do you see 3D printed guns as an asymmetric defense, either physically or digitally?
Well, now we are lowering the cost, at least in technical terms, for someone to be able to create a level of defense that before now, you know, required you to, in many cases, jump through various hoops in order to actually obtain a firearm legally. And I mostly like the idea of 3D printed guns because it allows you to have another level of robustness, basically this idea of having backups that if something goes wrong with your gun, you just make another one, you know, in less than a day or so. And that, I think, makes the most sense in terms of nation state style attacks. Of one of the main reasons why a lot of people in America are pro firearms, other than self-defense, is just the idea that it is really the last bastion of defense against tyranny. And so, you know, I often get asked by people, like, why do I have so many guns? I mean, I can only hold one or two guns at a time. One of my reasons for that, other than that I find them an interesting hobby, is that if we ever get to the point where my friends and family who don't have weapons end up needing them, then I'll be able to facilitate that. And I think that if we continue to see, you know, the proliferation of 3D printing gun technology, then you know, my cache of firearms may end up becoming obsolete because I can just create a new cache of firearms in a fairly short period of time as needed.
So with 3D printed guns, it's kind of two things. It's being able to make new ones, which is a big deal, obviously. And then it's also because they're digital files to begin with, it offers a similar protection to, say, Bitcoin, where there's some encryption maybe. Maybe the files are encrypted, or maybe they're sent through encrypted means so people don't know that they're being sent or what they have. And so now, just like similar to Bitcoin, to get at those files, it's slightly similar to Bitcoin in the sense of you're maybe using encryption in different various schemes to spread files. Like you might spread kind of the private keys with Bitcoin. Now you're spreading the files.
Well, you can't stop the signal, right? That's the main idea, is that, you know, every time we can take something physical that likes to be controlled by the government, you know, if authorities want to regulate it, if we can turn that physical thing into a digital thing, then it becomes basically impossible to regulate. You know, when it comes to the 3D printed guns, obviously we know how to protect and propagate the information required to print them. And then what we've done is we've basically taken it down to the base layer of the raw materials. And, you know, asking a government to regulate things like plastic or metal tubes, it just becomes laughable because, you know, these are common items that are used for a million different things.
Yeah, I see a lot of parallels with the 3D printing guns and Bitcoin. One of them being the decentralization, and decentralization in several ways. One, just the parts. Whereas a gun is a completed item that you then go and buy at a gun store, it's, you know, centralized by all a completed gun by companies that make them, and also the gun dealers, of course. Whereas with DIY guns, you've got plastic over here and you've got a metal bar over here and, you know, trigger components that you can buy from this other place. So just decentralizing that is a big advantage. And then, of course, it's decentralized in the manufacturer. So there might be 20 people who can make the same gun, and maybe all 20 of those people are off the radar. Maybe there's just one guy who's on the radar. They crack down on him, but the other 19 are still doing what they're doing. And another thing is, I think encryption comes from a Latin word meaning hidden, maybe something like that. I could be wrong. Then if you have these 3D files that are quote unquote hidden, that's another layer to all this. So it's kind of an exciting new world that we're moving towards, where it's this weird hybrid of the physical and the digital world. To combine two things, combining Bitcoin with 3D printed guns, this has been important for these guys. For example, if you want to print a Glock, in some of the models, you have to have this little aluminum rail. There's been a couple people who have started to make those and selling them, and the only way they can sell them is to accept Bitcoin for payments. For a couple of reasons. One, either they're not set up as a merchant, like they don't have a credit card account, things like that. But mostly it's been for kind of privacy reasons. And so to me, this has been a really great use case for Bitcoin, is being able to have this sort of censorship resistance and privacy. And they've done this not just for, say, buying aluminum rails, and these are perfectly legal rails. So it's kind of ridiculous they have to go to this extent, but that's what it is. But also some fundraising, like there was a bounty for someone to make a rifled barrel, 9mm, using electrochemical machining. And I think they had about $215. We contributed a little bit of Bitcoin to that. And so what role do you see Bitcoin playing in this future of 3D printed guns, or maybe the gun industry in general?
I believe that we're already pretty sure that we know what to expect from traditional payment processing companies. You know, we've already seen it happening on social media and somewhat on various crowdfunding platforms. But we basically have to expect that anyone who is doing controversial actions or saying controversial things is putting themselves at the risk of being deplatformed by whatever services they are relying upon. And so that is, of course, the primary use case of Bitcoin, is acting as this neutral platform that has no politics powering it. It is rather, you could even say it's powered by anti-politics. And, you know, if this movement continues to grow, then I expect there will continue to be more friction between the various platforms. You know, we're even seeing plenty of people in the 3D gun printing movement getting booted off of various social media, for example. Then I think that's just going to push more people towards using censorship-resistant solutions. And, you know, Bitcoin is just one of those.
Yeah, I agree. And this is why I've been talking a lot lately about not emphasizing so much HODL. It's very important to HODL. It helps people, it helps Bitcoin, but remembering that Bitcoin does have this incredible power for censorship-resistant payments. And we've seen different platforms, like you said, kick off gun owners and gun businesses like Shopify, PayPal, Stripe. They won't do business with gun-related things. And of course, you have things like Patreon and all these other platforms where you just can't use their system for any gun-related things. And I agree with you, this is going to continue to escalate, and it's going to be about deplatforming and mobs. For example, this morning I was on Keybase in one of the gun groups, and someone shared this research article. And basically they said that people doing these DIY guns are extremists. And then you've seen people say that, you know, like the Virginia rally was like this white supremacist Nazi rally, even though there was people of all races and walks of life there. And this is a new tactic that they're now going to use, is calling people, they're going to call gun owners and gun advocates racist and white supremacists, which is a very, very powerful way to, you know, defeat people and to deplatform. And so before, you can be blocked from certain services just by having legitimate gun business. In the future, I think you'll be blocked from services just by being labeled a gun supremacist or an extremist or a white supremacist. And that's very, very dangerous.
Or an ammosexual.
An ammosexual is something you brag about, but you're right. Maybe that'll be the latest tag that they'll put on you. And yeah, you're dangerous. Well, Jameson, thanks for coming on the show. Let's wrap up. So, Jameson, what are you working on in the next 6 months and year?
The same thing I've been working on for the past 5 years, which is really self-custody of private keys. It is, for the first 3 years I was full-time Bitcoin, I was at BitGo working on enterprise, multi-sig, non-custodial solutions. And then for the past 2 years at Casa, I've been working on a similar thing, but targeted for individuals and helping people self-custody their own keys. And it really is about thinking through all of the things that can go wrong. We have our threat model that is hosted on docs.keys.casa. That's docs.keys.casa, which goes through the threat model that we developed our software solution around. And really, the Casa Keymaster is a multi-signature, multi-device, multi-location setup where we try to ensure that there is no single point of failure in the entire setup so that you're robust both against digital attackers, physical attackers, and all types of natural disasters.
And what are the different membership levels or pricing for the Casa services?
We've got a few different levels. Entry level is only about $10 a month. We then have some higher tier levels that are a lot more hands-on and customized for each individual. And those range in the like several hundred dollars per month. And there are different services around basically inheritance and team-based signing stuff at the extreme levels, where that's really for people who find themselves in the position of having like a significant fraction of their net worth in Bitcoin and, you know, want to self-custody themselves, but perhaps they don't have the technical sophistication or simply the time to think through a threat model that encompasses everything that can go wrong. And so I think that's where a lot of our value add is just around the amount of time and experience that we've put into thinking adversarially and then building a very user-friendly interface that's a point and click for people to manage their keys.
I'll include a link to, of course, Casa, the documents link, and your other articles, one about, you know, OPSEC, and then the other one about personal security and all these things, so that people can kind of take a look at what you guys do, and maybe they want to sign up for it, or maybe just can learn something that they can do themselves. So, Jameson, thanks again for coming on the Guns and Bitcoin podcast.
My pleasure.
We're here to give you the tools and stories to thrive and survive the cyberpunk dystopia. Obviously, this is an awesome podcast. So as soon as you're done, stop what you're doing and subscribe to the Guns and Bitcoin podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or whichever app you use. After that, please rate our show. If you can't get enough of us, subscribe to our newsletter. Our newsletter will have special promotions and exclusive content. The web address for our newsletter is gunsandbitcoin.substack.com. Follow us on Twitter. We have regular contests with our awesome gear as prizes, and we tweet the occasional discount code. Our Twitter handle is @gunsandbitcoin. Finally, if there are any topics you'd like for us to cover or any guests you'd like us to interview, our email is podcast@gunsandbitcoin.com.